Hello, dear foodie friends, and welcome to Kitchen Chat. This is your host, Margaret McSweeney, and I'm so glad you're joining me in my kitchen today. I thought it would be really special to do a special encore of Kitchen Chat with Alice Waters. What a joy it was to sit down with her at Chez Panisse several years ago and hear about her culinary journey. Yes, the queen of the garden, Alice Waters. So this, of course, was all recorded pre-COVID, and I just thought it's a great story that you'd love to hear again. So enjoy and savor the day.
Welcome to Kitchen Chat. This is where we sample the talents of the most notorious chefs, home cooks, foodies, and celebrities that sizzle. Get ready for a culinary journey that you won't find anywhere else. Here's the host of Kitchen Chat, Margaret McSweeney.
The destiny of nations depends on how we nourish ourselves. And I use that all the time, that we really are what we eat. And when we eat fast food, we eat the values that come along with the food, that more is better, that time is money, that cooking is drudgery, that farming is drudgery. All of those ideas come along with the fast food, that it's okay to eat in your car, that food should be fast, cheap, and easy, when we know, really, that food is something precious.
Food is indeed something precious. I'm so glad you're joining me for today's Kitchen Chat with Chef Alice Waters. I wanted to just set the table for you before we play the full interview. It was such a culinary milestone in my own journey to go to Chez Panisse and sit down with her. She had prepared one of her favorite recipes, she calls it, from the garden, fresh mint. And then she pours hot water over that and just serves it like tea. So here she had this beautiful table arrangement with cups of hot water and mint as we sat around her office table at Chez Panisse for this interview. She truly is just, I like to call her a counterculture culinary hero in bringing us all back to the garden. Her lessons on sustainability are key. How she says, never compromise on sustainability. It's the bottom line. Also, how she shares with us her edible education and how she continues those efforts through the Edible Schoolyard Project. And also, she shares just such beautiful culinary history with us through her stories and through her own life experiences. And it was truly an honor to feature her on Kitchen Chat. And so thank you again. I hope you enjoy this. I would love to hear from you. Visit my kitchen, kitchenchat.info, and savor the day. I just am beyond honored to be here, Chef.
It's a pleasure for me, too.
Thank you. Well, I have just completely read every single page of your latest book, and it just encapsulates your journey. And I love how you preface it by saying, my childhood and young adulthood, it turned out, held the seeds of my own edible education, the values that empowered me to gather a group of like-minded friends and open the doors, barely, of a little French restaurant in Berkeley, California in 1971. And here I am with you today at Chez Panisse. This is just incredible what you envisioned and what you built.
Well, I never envisioned what is here now. I just was very, very naive and passionate. And I wanted a little place where my friends could gather and that we could, you know, we could eat something good. And I wanted it to be French because I had been so inspired when I went to France when I was 19. And I had those tastes in my mind. And I thought somehow we could make that happen.
And you have, and I love how, well, first of all, you're so highly acclaimed, so many awards and so many organizations, but I love that your very first award ever truly set the table. And that was winning the Queen of the Garden contest.
Well, I think I must have been 4 years old.
Yes.
And my mother addressed me as the Queen of the Garden for a little neighborhood costume contest, and I think I won first prize, and I had an asparagus skirt with the leaves of the asparagus, and I had lettuce sleeves top, and I had a crown of strawberries on my head, and peppers bracelets and anklets, so I must have been influenced by that experience and excited about it. But my parents had a victory garden during World War II to really feed themselves. And they kept that for their whole lives and always gardened and always canned things. And we hardly ever went out to eat when I was a kid. So I was really unprepared for what I experienced in France when I was 19. Really unprepared.
And what do you think was the pivotal moment in France that really connected with your spirit?
Probably the little French strawberries, those wild strawberries from the woods, the Fraises des Bois. And I was served a plate of those, a little pile of them, and they brought to the table some cream and a sugar shaker. And I had never seen that berry before. And it was fragrant in a way that I still remember. So I just captured that. And I had many, many food experiences that were like that, where I'd have a warm baguette and apricot jam, or I had an oyster right out of the water. And I just didn't know about a farmer's market. I'd never seen one. And all of a sudden, all the food is right there. And it's so beautiful and changing in the seasons, and little French restaurants that were very enticing. So I really had an edible education.
Yes, and you're sharing it with the world, and you have. And I love how you're known as the food revolutionary person and the counterculture of food. And I love that it has been fought with asparagus spears and garlic bulbs in terms of making a difference. And could you share with us about your love and passion for garlic?
Well, I do really believe in winning people over. I don't expect to convince them by talking to them that they should engage in this delicious revolution. I want to feed them the idea that garlic is one of the best ways because it's so pungent and it's so deeply, I think, in the cooking of the world, in all cuisines, some more than others, but it's always been there. So I think we have, as human beings, almost a taste memory for it. And certainly garlic bread has had made quite an impression in this country, although I've never had garlic bread like the garlic bread I had in France. And I think now there are many, many people who know that it's so great when it's, you know, the bread is cooked over the fire, on the grill, and then it's rubbed with fresh garlic when it comes off the grill, and then drizzled with olive oil. Nothing better.
I love that. And I love your description in the book, too, where you talk about making grilled cheese sandwiches and putting the garlic on that and putting a cast iron skillet on top of the sandwich.
Well, I make it probably a little differently than other people do, but I use olive oil, not butter, in the pan, and I weight it down so it gets very browned on both sides. I use the smaller cast iron pan to hold it down, and when it comes off the heat, again, I cut a clove of garlic and rub it on both sides, because it sort of cooks it and it makes it just very tasty.
Yes, I love that. And I think I have a new nickname for you as well, and that's Madam Mesclun, because you brought the seeds. Can you tell us about that?
I had a very good friend who lived in the south of France, my friend Martine, that I talk about in the book. And she would take me to the farmer's market. Mm-hmm. And particularly in the springtime, the farmers would bring in this mix of lettuce, and a mix in sort of Niçoise dialect is called mesclun, M-E-S-C-L-U-N.
Yes.
And I love that, the way she made that salad with garlic and anchovy dressing. And it was always kind of spicy with rocket and a little bitter with frisée and dandelion greens. And it just felt like the farmer was just walking around his field and cutting and then putting it in a big basket and mixing it up and bringing it to the farmer's market.
Wow. And so you brought those seeds right back to the United States.
It's true. And one of the other ingredients in it is truffle, which I had never really had before I went to France. And I love the salad so much, I brought it back. And in the early days of the restaurant, I planted those seeds in my backyard, and the whole backyard was a mesclun salad mix, and we became very well known for this unusual. We added a little bit of color to it that wasn't in the original mix of red oak leaf lettuces, and so it had different shapes and colors, and it turned into our own little homegrown mix.
Yes, a backyard feast. And I love too, because you're such a culinary artist, and you too have the vision of that taste, just like Claude Monet, who brought zucchini seeds from Provence up to northern France.
Is that so?
Yes. Yes.
He certainly knew how to paint nature and really, I guess, taste it too. I've read books about his cooking or people who cooked in his house, and he certainly was a gourmet.
Yes, and I'm just so glad you had that vision, too, of taste, of really beginning a legacy of salad here in the United States and putting it on the forefront.
Almost every dish at the restaurant has a little salad someplace. I just think it's a great way to sort of punctuate something that's rich. And then you just have a little bit of salad green. And it's a way that I sort of balance a plate.
Yes. And I love, too, a beautiful story in here about how James Beard let you borrow some of his wooden bowls for a special event.
Yes. Maybe I should read that part. No, it's a good story.
Yes.
I went to New York in the late 70s to receive this Playboy magazine award for the best 25 restaurants in the United States. We were number 7. And I was the only woman who was in that group. And I just thought, well, what really represents Chez Panisse? And I thought, it's salad. You know, it's a green salad. And so my friend Mary Cunningham knew James Beard, and she said I could go to his house and that he would loan me a salad bowl. And I brought the salad from California, and I washed the lettuces at his house, and I brought this as my dish. And of course, when I got there at the reception, all the French chefs were doing elaborate, you know, lobster thermidor, and I can't even remember the amazing things that were going on around me. And I was so embarrassed. I was so aware that that I had brought something so simple, so plain. And it was kind of an excruciating night. I kept trying to tell people, well, it's James Beard's salad bowl, and he thinks it's all right that I'm here with a salad. But the next day, the news wrote about my salad. And so I never worried ever again about something being too plain, too obvious. I especially something that was very tasty and very important in our diets.
Yes, and this book just overflows with these amazing stories that you share along your culinary journey. And I love what was so poignant, and I'm going to try to find that quote. Here it is. I underlined it, wrote it. A quote you included by Brulas Savarin. I don't know if I'm...
Brulas Savarin.
Okay. And it says, "The destiny of nations depends upon the manner in which they were fed."
Indeed.
Yes.
I believe this. And some people translate that as the destiny of nations depends on how we nourish ourselves. And I use that all the time, that we really are what we eat. And when we eat fast food, we eat the values that come along with the food, that more is better, that time is money, that cooking is drudgery, that farming is drudgery. All of those ideas come along with the fast food, that it's okay to eat in your car, that you know, food should be fast, cheap, and easy, when we know really that food is something precious and that we can't never waste it. It's not, you know, it's not, there's always more where that came from.
Right.
Which is another kind of fast food value. And these are the values that have really changed our world. And we have to come back to our senses.
Yes.
As my book suggests, that we need to come back to the human values that are so important to teach our children. That gathering at the table is something that's been around since the beginning of civilization. And it's a time to pause in the day and share food and learn about each other and take time. So I'm really struggling to initiate a national edible education course in the schools.
Yes. And is this through your Edible Schoolyard initiatives? And can you please share with the listeners about that and how we can help, how we can come alongside?
Well, we've been doing a project in a middle school in Berkeley for the last 22 years. It's a middle school, and there are 1,000 kids. They speak 22 different languages at home. So it's a very good cross-section for trying out this idea. And the principal of the school was very excited to think about a garden classroom and a kitchen classroom that could be connected to the academic studies. And that's what we built. We built this edible schoolyard garden classroom. And so the kids come out there, and they may be planting seeds and growing food, but it's part of a math class. So they're calculating this, and they're learning about worm boxes as part of science. Mm. And they're in a kitchen classroom, and maybe they're learning the history of the Arabian Peninsula, and they're eating a tabbouleh salad, and they're eating some hummus, and they're making that. So it's like they're learning by doing, and they are really digesting the information, their academic information. It's coming in through all their senses. So they really remember. It's always been the best way to teach, as Montessori certainly proved. But we don't do that. Right. We keep kids in the classroom in chairs, when in high school, they really need to be out of their chairs and out into the world. And so I think there's an enormous opportunity to take school lunch and make it part of academia and give it the time and attention for children to really taste and experience real food.
I have goosebumps all over. This is so poignant and so life-changing, so fundamental to the foundation of education and bringing the kids back to the garden, kind of having your own farmer's market at school.
In fact, it is like that because we're worried about the planet and the future. How are we going to get along, and how are we going to nourish ourselves, and how are we going to take care of this precious planet that feeds us? And so we need to learn that from kindergarten. And I think that this is a very delicious lesson. And if we could feed every child for free at school, like they've just done in New York. But I want them to be fed real food from farmers who take care of the land. And if that happened, we could really lift up those farmers with the teachers as the people, the citizens that are most valuable to us, really. Yes. They're the ones that have the possibility of really bringing our children into a very positive relationship to themselves, to their own personal health and well-being. And that's a big part of what learning is all about. Yeah. It's feeling good and really connecting with your classmates at the table.
Yes.
It's really fundamental, as you said, yes. And I can't imagine that we really wouldn't prioritize it and decide that we're going to pay up front instead of out back. Mm-hmm. We pay later in all of our health, right, and in the degradation of the environment. And why not pay up front?
Yes, and then with this whole edible schoolyard project. So I'll make sure that I have the link to the website.
Great. Yes. I think that's the best way to get connected. We want to make school lunch an academic subject.
Yes, I love that.
So when you're in studying the Silk Road in India, you might be eating those delicious lentil soup and a chapati. Maybe you're having a carrot salad with cumin, and you're experiencing something of India that helps you forever remember.
Absolutely. And here on Kitchen Chat, I always say the kitchen is the heart of the home. But in reality, the kitchen is the heart of the world, and food is the universal language.
I really believe that, you don't, when you go to another country and you're at the table, you can always communicate, you know, with your hands, and you know how to talk about that. And it's so beautiful that we can offer that kind of hospitality without any language and really delight people. And so that's all part of it, is we're teaching children to share and to learn about portion size, to learn how to use the entirety of a vegetable, to learn how to cook so that we're not dependent on the fast food nation that is trying to sell us something. We can make affordable meals for ourselves.
Yes.
You know, and the best thing about the Edible Schoolyard Project in this 22 years of doing it is when you grow the food, the kids grow the food and cook it, they all eat it. And that is a truth. If they just grow it, 95% eat it. Or if they just cook it. But when they do both, they eat it. And it's about empowerment. And they feel like somebody's trusting them to make decisions about their own well-being.
Mm-hmm.
I always say it's 6 weeks to kale.
I love that. I love that. And also, I understand your daughter, Fanny, is very passionate about making changes. And can you share with us about her efforts at Yale a few years back?
About when she was in college, I was pretty shocked by what was being served in the cafeteria. And I immediately went right to the president and I said, oh my goodness, maybe I could help. At first he thought I wanted to come and cook at his house. And then I told him that I had an idea for feeding all of the students at Yale food that partially might be grown in a garden owned by the university. And he said, well, we'll find one of the colleges here at Yale that would be willing to do this experiment. And it turned out to be Berklee College.
Aww.
And my daughter ultimately lived off campus. And as the garden flourished at Yale, she was always going there to pick her mezcalant salad. So it was a very important idea that is still needing to be realized in all dimensions, but college students are ready for this now. And I think that this could really happen at the University of California because they have always been a land-grant university. The university, and there are lands that they could plant gardens, like at UC Santa Cruz. And I'm very hopeful that they could support the farmers in California that are doing the right thing, the farmers and the ranchers who take care of the land for the future of us all.
Oh, This is just the generations that you have impacted and that you continue to impact through all of your efforts by being a counterculture culinary hero here and championing the cause.
And I can never leave the hopefulness that I've felt in the 60s behind, because I really felt part of the counterculture movement. We didn't believe what the government was telling us. We wanted to stop the war in Vietnam, and we did. And we were empowered by that. But we felt, by standing together and sharing the values of equality around the civil rights movement, there are many, many things that were very, very important to us, and they still are to me. And I feel certain that if we focus on that and we come together, we can change the world.
Absolutely, and change it one bite at a time, for sure.
Well, every day we have three opportunities, maybe even more, if we're lucky. And we can buy with determination. We can look to see who is doing the right thing and purchase our food from that farmer, that rancher at the farmer's market, or even in stores, to ask the questions, to read the packages, and make the right decision.
Oh, I love that. Well, as you can imagine, I have so many questions that have come in from social media. You're just so adored by everyone. And one interesting question that came from Canada, from a chef, Chef Francisco in Toronto. He was just so curious, and I know you touched upon it a bit, but he said, how has it been, and especially at the beginning, to be one of the only women in a male-dominated industry? How did that impact?
You know, it didn't really affect me at the beginning. I just felt like we all could do what we wanted to do. If we did it well, we would succeed. And I felt empowered by that counterculture movement. I knew that they would come and eat at the restaurant. And so I wasn't self-conscious about it. But again, it was kind of my restaurant. Mm-hmm. And we had actually three women at the very beginning who worked in major positions of pastry and the main cook in the kitchen. And we have always had a nice balance of men and women. I think it's very important in the kitchen. And they bring different things to the cooking. But I know that it's very difficult. It's very difficult to keep restaurant hours, especially if you have children, both for men and for women. Yeah. And so we have tried to be very sensitive about that, having people work days and nights, having people work 4 days instead of five or six. It's very demanding work at a time when your family is eating dinner or eating lunch. Right. And so we need to, as a business, to be thinking about that all of the time.
Absolutely. And you're investing in their sustainability as well.
Exactly. Well, again, these were the values that I learned from my time of living in Berkeley and living through the difficult period in the 60s and in the 70s. Mm. And we are in a difficult time right now. And so it's important that we think about these things and make our communities reflect our values.
Yes.
And so I want this restaurant to always express, well, first and foremost, our love for the farmer.
This is just so powerful, so powerful. And real quickly, you have impacted even Chicago from where I am from, with the Green City Market, working with Mayor Daley and Abby Mendel. And Sharon Myers was asking a question in terms of what was your inspiration in doing that? How did, in a nutshell, did that all happen?
Well, we had such a beautiful farmers market here in San Francisco. And I knew it could be successful if it was dedicated to sustainable agriculture. Mm-hmm. And when Abby was beginning, she kept saying, but what do we do in the winter? You have such a long growing season. How are we going to manage? And I just said, Abby, maybe you'll have to move inside in the wintertime. Maybe you'll have to go bit by bit, but don't ever compromise the idea of sustainability. And because that's the bottom line, that once you give in, and this means about all of the prepared food too, should all be organically grown. And she kept to that. And I think really that that's what made that so successful, that Green City Market, that it had that deeply dug roots in the right place. And I just admired her and cheerlead for her. But I think Chicago was fertile. I think it is very fertile. It's close to a lot of farms. Yes. It has just a passionate group of restaurateurs and a lot of people that care. So it was so exciting to be there, to watch this happen in another big city. And I went to upstate Michigan, and I found the same thing happening in and around Traverse City. And I know it's going on in Milwaukee, and with people like Will Allen farming there. Yeah. It's just remarkable what he can do in a greenhouse in the middle of winter, growing kale, and it's just organically, and it's amazing.
Yes, and to think about how the beginning was really these seeds of mesclun, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, that you brought, and how you have now scattered and planted seeds to grow farmers markets around the country and to inspire people. This is so inspirational.
Well, thank you. But I have to say again that these are not new ideas that I dreamed up. These are ideas as old as civilization. The idea of taking care of the land, because that's where our food comes from, of composting, of eating with family and friends, of being absolutely in the season that you are in, saving things from the summer to use in the winter, the idea of celebrating the harvest. These are all ideas that I think we all have inside us as human beings, and we just need to find them again.
And you, this book and your life and your continuing efforts through everything are just it's the GPS for us. Yeah. But I always like to end Kitchen Chat with three quick tips for the home chef that you'd like to share.
It's important to cook every day, even if it's something very, very simple. I make myself a little avocado taco in the morning and just have the pleasure of the cooking the tortilla on the stove and smelling that. And just that it's so gratifying to take the time to make a point of sitting with family and friends every day, but begin at least once or twice a week, that you make it a ritual. It's so important. And again, I think the second is really to support the farmers markets, to go out of your way to give the money directly to the people, because their work is invaluable. And I guess the third most important is, if you can, to plant something with your children or without, wherever you can, because it's just, aside from being gratifying, it is so important for the planet that we just get back into that spirit of the Victory Garden and know that we can really feed ourselves, you know, actually for free in a way, aside from the hard work. But I think that self-reliance is something terribly important right now.
Thank you so much, Chef Alice Waters. This is truly a milestone in my culinary journey. And I just appreciate your edible education. And listeners, I'll make sure that you have a link to her book, Coming to My Senses, The Making of a Counterculture Cook by Chef Alice Waters. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Oh. Really. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, dear foodie friends. Please keep in touch. Visit me in my kitchen, kitchenchat.info. And always remember to take a moment and savor the day.